listening to Latin Experts, a podcast of Latino studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Latin Experts features the voices of faculty, staff, and students, as well as friends and alumni of the Department of Mexican American and Latino Studies, the Latino Research Institute, and the Center for Mexican American Studies. So, what do we mean by experts? An expert is a person who has a comprehensive and authoritative knowledge of or skill in a particular area. Latinos aren't often associated with expertise. A Latin expert, then, occupies the space cautiously. A Latin expert admits they have knowledge and an important perspective, but leads with questions instead of answers, acknowledges what they don't know, and is always accountable to Latinx communities. Join us for this episode of Latin Experts. Police and vigilante violence against Black people in the United States never stops. But sometimes, certain instances of anti-Black harm catalyze the people to rise up in rebellion, to demand that things change. Such is the case of the spring and summer of 2020. As we lived with the ever-present threat of the COVID-19 pandemic, four police or vigilante murders grabbed national attention. Ahmaud Arbery in Atlanta, Georgia, Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky, Tony McDade in Tallahassee, Florida, and George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Despite the health risk, people took their rage to the streets, and at the time I speak, they continue to take those streets, demanding an end to police violence and asserting that Black lives matter. The Pew Research Center reports that as many as 1 in 4 U.S. Latinos identify as Afro-Latinx. The movement for Black lives, then, is deeply integral to Latinx communities. Yet, for many throughout the United States, regardless of their ethnic or racial identity, Latino is synonymous with mestizaje, or brownness. For many white and mestizo Latinx folks, Blackness and Black issues seem separate from Latinx issues, an implicitly and often explicitly anti-Black racist point of view. The Department of Mexican American and Latino Studies at UT is comprised largely of non-Afro-Latinx faculty. A group of these faculty decided it is our responsibility to provide resources to our communities to be able to address anti-Blackness in Latinx communities. This multi-part series of Latin Experts is our imperfect attempt to do just that. To be clear, although some of the voices featured in this series are Afro-Latinx and experts in questions related to Afro-Latinx communities and anti-Blackness, many of us are not. We are simply Latinx people and Latino studies scholars with a political obligation to ask hard questions, share what we know and have experienced, and hold ourselves and our communities accountable to Black people. Join us as we launch our new podcast with a special multi-part series on anti-Blackness and Afro-Latinidad in Latinx communities. Episode 1. Why does Grandma love Celia Cruz but hate Black people? In this episode, we will hear from Lara G. Gutierrez and Jesus I. Valles. Gutierrez is associate professor in the Department of Mexican American and Latino Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Her research and teaching interests are in Mexican and Latinx performance studies and visual culture studies, popular culture, feminist theory, queer theory, and critical race theory. She is the author of Performing Mexicanidad, Vendidas y Cabareteras on the Transnational Stage, and she's completing a monograph on queer intimacies in contemporary Latinx visual art, performance art, and video film work. Jesus I. Valles is a queer Mexican immigrant and writer-performer from Juarez, Mexico, and El Paso, Texas. Jesus is a 2019 Lambda Literary Fellow, a 2019 Fellow of the Sewanee Writers Conference, a 2018 Andaki Poets Fellow, and a 2018 Tin House Scholar. They have received support from Fine Arts Work Center, Community of Writers at Squaw Valley, Idlewild Arts, and the Poetry Incubator. Their work is published in The New Republic, Palabritas, The Acentos Review, Quarterly Rest, and Tin House. They are the author and performer of the solo show, Undocuments. Let's listen to Laura and Jesus.
Hi, everyone. So happy to be here with Jesus Valles to have this conversation about anti-Blackness in Latinx communities. And one of the things that we want to talk about, more so than offer answers, because we don't presume to have answers for any of this, but just open up important conversations, is the ways it's through pop culture, right? Even the question that opens up our series with this episode, why does grandma love Celia Cruz but hate Black people? It's already problematic, right? Because it presumes that the grandma, the abuelita here, is, you know, a non-Black grandma, right? Mm-hmm. So sort of just start off with that, acknowledging the assumption there. But it's a question that I pose to my undergrad students here at UT whenever we talk about performers, musicians, singers, Black body performers, musicians, singers like Celia Cruz within Latinidad. So I wanted, you know, to sort of have Jesus here with me to just engage these pop culture conversations and anti-Blackness in Latinidad.
Yeah, yeah. I find the question really, really interesting. One, because I also think, and it's interesting that this question of the abuela, right, as the sort of the like final gatekeeper, your last barrier, the sort of final frontier in negotiating cultural conversations, I think in so many Latinx contexts, always returns to the abuela, right? Like just in thinking about diasporas and different Latinx diasporas, right? I'm also thinking about what the conversation is and what connections there are between this question of why does abuelita love Celia Cruz but hate Black people? And where is that question also in conversation with the question, ¿y tu abuela dónde está? Which is, you know, which is one that you hear a lot.
In the closet.
Right.
The Black grandmother in the closet.
Right, which mm-hmm. is something that I think you hear a lot. You definitely hear it a lot more in Caribbean Latinx communities. But I think it's interesting that so often that question is one that ends and begins at the matriarch. And two, what does it mean for this sort of interesting split between what we see as the cultural product and the person embodying it in popular culture in general? Because I do think, so just to be sort of specific and upfront, I grew up in Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico. And my introduction, I think, to Blackness and to thinking about Blackness was first grounded in Mexicanidad, right? And what Blackness meant in the sort of visual spectrum of Mexican pop culture, specifically in telenovelas. So I'm thinking about the first thing that I can think about is Carrusel de las Americas. And the way in which the Black characters in that show are, one, relegated to this kind of really strange nobility, and the nobility is all based off of their failure to please or comply with whiteness, right? You have Ludwika Paleta sort of playing this kind of, like, object of desire, even in a children's novela, which I think is super bizarre, but, you know, it is what it is. And that for me, I think, and first, I think so many Mexican children, at least in the 90s, was sort of our introduction, you know? Mm-hmm. Flash forward to today, where I think so many of the folks who are closer to the age that I was when I was first sort of introduced to Blackness in a Latinx context, I think are now having the conversation much more explicitly, much more openly, in much more complex ways. And I think so much of that is due to, reggaeton and to its audio landscape and to what absences are present there. It's interesting. I think there's obviously so much to be said about this. Mm-hmm. And I actually would love to ask you, where does the framing for the conversation to be, why does abuelita love Celia Cruz but hate Black people? Like, where do you think that question is developed or born or where is that? That's where is that? How is it that that question emerges, I guess?
Wow. Yeah, thank you for that. It actually has a lot to do with what you were saying earlier in relationship to sort of the ways in which I've both personally and professionally have encountered Blackness within Latinidad. And it has to do with the consumption of pop culture. And when you mentioned the telenovela, that sort of is your first access to Blackness. And Mexicanidad, I thought that you were actually going to sort of go back further, which is, you know, probably sort of I'm thinking about myself and my own kind of entry into Blackness within the telenovela genre and Mexicanidad mm-hmm. with, you know, El Derecho de Nacer.
Yes.
And that reiteration, right, the right to be born that has to do with, you know, having that, you know, sort of Black past, the Black grandmother in the closet, right? She's in the closet. She's invisible, and she doesn't deserve to be out of the closet as a grandma, as sort of a biological connection with this, you know, this this woman who, like, is hating on her mulatta child. As a white woman, she bears a mulatta child. Anyway, I won't tell you the story because it's sort of so present and so relevant and so prevalent within within that visual landscape of Mexicanidad. But, you know, it actually has to do with the ways in which I think the entertainment sort of aspect of Blackness is often relegated to sort of the backdrop or sort of the Black dancing doll, which is also another prevalent figure within Mexicanidad, right? Mm-hmm. So that kind of like absence, but in the background, and if you're foregrounded, it is for the entertainment of the, you know, of the public, right? Of the Mexican mestizo nation of, you know, of Mexico. But in relationship to the ways in which this question comes up is with my students here at UT and in other locations in the Southwest where, you know, it's sort of mostly Mexican and the students are mostly mestizos, first generation students who are, you know, mostly mestizos of Mexican background who tell me that, you know, they know of Celia Cruz because their grandmother loves Celia Cruz. So we use Celia Cruz sort of as a way to sort of prop that question open, right? In terms of sort of thinking about why Celia Cruz is accepted as a Latina performer, but not as a Black person, right? So that's where that question comes from yeah. sort of having that conversation with my students. And again, as you said, we can sort of continue to sort of dig deeper into and in more complex ways, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
I mean, I'm really fascinated by that idea of reaching back, right? That there is this kind of continuum between, you know, watching Carrusel de las Americas, which is like early 90s, and then El Derecho de Nacer, mm-hmm. and even the language that I think is easily offered culturally to folks to talk about Blackness, right? Like, in describing this mixed race person, I think the use of the word mulata, mm-hmm. I think is also really really interesting because it, you know, it's an inheritance, it's an heirloom, right, of the casta system and the way that particular popular cultural product in its time sort of became the thing that helped to dictate language that relegated Blackness to like animalia or to the animal and what that did to sort of frame how people think about Blackness today, you know, even today when we think about larger conversations about how the Black body is viewed in Latinx families, and this is a conversation that I think has happened a lot more recently as a lot of younger folks who are tuned into how cultural products are made are watching Univision and Telemundo report on the uprisings that are happening here in the United States, and they're watching their parents react. And I think it's a really interesting moment of reckoning, because I think all of these conversations about how popular culture influences how we talk about Blackness in non-Black Latinx communities and families, I think it's a kind of moment where all of these things are coming to a head, because now we're watching our parents actively participate, mm-hmm. and watch these images, watch the uprisings, watch the news, with only pop culture as their primary tool for sense making. And here you have a new generation of folks, of a lot of younger Latinx, non-Black folks, who I think are now sort of struggling and trying to carry that question of what it means to have that confrontation with their families and with their parents, and also try to negotiate that through pop culture, right? Mm-hmm. So what does it mean to listen to Bad Bunny and know that all of the threads that make his music work, all of the things that make his sonic choices popular and palatable, right, are because they are remnants of a very specific kind of colonialism and anti-Black violence that takes the music and takes the cultural product and leaves behind the body that originates it or makes it. Which I think is really, really interesting, because it's interesting that all of this is happening in living rooms, right? That these larger conversations that mm-hmm. I think a lot of times we want to say mm-hmm. happen in academic spaces mm-hmm. can actually happen at the kitchen table in the living room, mm-hmm. and I'm really interested in what those conversations might be, and I think it would be fascinating to also think about like what cultural products people are sort of screening and thinking about Blackness through in this moment. Mm-hmm. In terms of thinking about our current moment, right, and what's happening now, what's your sort of take or what are your thoughts on the way that celebrities like Selena Gomez or Bad Bunny have responded to this moment, right, and this movement?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually, you know, was thinking about Bad Bunny too, in relationship to sort of the ways in which, you know, these legacies are continued through, you know, sort of mostly the sort of the 20th century, which is the moment in which I move my students through and kind of already begin to tell them that a lot of the modes of representation that they're being critical about, because we have, you know, quite a sort of group of woke students that are analyzing everything through the lens of race and class and mm-hmm. gender and sexuality. But one of the things that I do is to sort of pry open the contemporary moment and say, you know, there's actually legacies and histories of, you know, performers from early 20th century that were doing the same exact thing, right? You know, how is it different? How is it working differently?
Yeah.
So totally, I mean, Bad Bunny would be an example of the ways in which, you know, sort of the use of Afro-diasporic music moves through his body and through his song, through his, as you said, the audioscape of Bad Bunny, but makes it palatable. That's like the question for us always, you know, in my classes, which has to do with, you know, pop culture as, you know, part of this sort of capitalist driven system mm-hmm. of, you know, of profit gain. So there's always money behind, you know, and what is the belief? The belief is that, you know, the only sort of palatable images, or sounds through certain types of bodies are going to be consumed or consumable, right? And the students are, you know, and in general, this generation that you were talking about is putting a stop to it, you know, and having these difficult conversations with mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, and the rest of the family, right? So, you know, they're the ones that are also bringing these conversations to the classroom, right? So it's like not only just about the racial hierarchies that are, you know, sort of perpetuated through telenovelas, but also, you know, sort of the gender and the sexism and the misogyny mm-hmm. in telenovelas, that the students are right. like putting a stop to that too, right? So I think that, you know, hopefully this will kind of change, and since these people will be the ones who are going to be producing, you know, culture in the future.
Culture, yeah.
That, yeah. But, you know, what's interesting to me about, you know, Bad Bunny is that there was, like, silence from him. Like, no right. one was, like, everyone was, like, what is Bad Boy? His Bad Bunny? Like, he was so open about, you know, during the sort of the COVID moment. And you know, we knew what he was doing in his, you know, compound in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, the uprising happened and silence from him. Yeah. And there was so much expectation. And then he comes out with this very lame kind of, support. I think he disappointed a lot of people that were wanting more from Bad Bunny.
Yeah. The meagerness of the response.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas someone like Selena Gomez comes out and surprises people, and then, you know, the one that is often critique of, like, exploiting her Latinidad is, like, the one that says, I'm just going to give up my Instagram and use my platform and just sort of, you know, just take a back seat and, you know, sort of just let people take over my Instagram.
Yeah.
Black people who have been in the movement and are, you know, figures that we all should know. And the use of a platform has sort of altered the way that I perceive Selena, right? Selena mm-hmm. Gomez. So that's also, you know, sort of an interesting moment that we're sort of finding ourselves in, right? Where we have so little expectation from someone like Selena Gomez, who comes out and surprises us, whereas Bad Bunny is, like, not there, or not with that strength that people were expecting.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm actually really, really interested in the sort of, what's interesting, too, about the kind of interruption that social media has. Now, I don't even know if it's interruption, but a kind of mediation, right? That social that social media has had on these conversations, specifically because I'm thinking a lot about the ways in which the political or social or cultural happens, and usually, right, the logic would say the political moment, the cultural moment, the inciting incident, right, happens, and then the celebrity responds or the cultural makers. Responds via product or statement. Mm-hmm. And I think what has happened with social media, and I'm specifically thinking about Instagram and TikTok, mm-hmm. about those two platforms, is that they're now kind of providing this third prong where the audience is also creating cultural products, right? Like mm-hmm. that a fan can get enough likes or follows or retweets or reposts or regrams, right? In their post that calls out the silence from these celebrities, and also become a kind of popular culture maker, right? That the meme also intervenes, mm-hmm. and I'm really taken by that, by the way in which so many of the folks who are consuming popular culture are also now making the cultural products that respond to it, and they're becoming the bridge that sort of attempts to have these more difficult conversations and attempts to understand and place the cultural products they're consuming, right? The music, the mm-hmm. videos, the shows, mm-hmm. In a larger conversation and in a larger context. And I'm in many ways really sort of inspired by the possibility that what I'll call, like, the meme, right? But yeah, the response, the screenshot, the tweet thread, how those things get passed around and become cultural products that become shorthand for so many of these conversations. Mm-hmm. And as I think my friend Tressie McMillan-Cottom, who's a sociologist, I think she phrased it best. On Sunday night, she tweeted, this generation really did the reading. And that, to me, is really inspiring. And I hope that